It's time for our Sunday morning chat show on Radio Silly. Fraser is my guest. If you hear any funny noises in the background, it's Percy the dog. Well, guys, it could be Fraser. It could be me, for that matter, couldn't it? But it's most likely going to be the dog. Your companion.
He is. That's right. Yeah, young Percy's here having a sniff around, checking the place out.
I know. It's quite insulting, really, isn't it? He's finding a lot to sniff here. So we always start, Fraser, with these chats with right at the beginning, chronological order and all that. So where were you born?
I was born on Scilly, obviously born at the hospital at St Mary's in 1959, December the 5th, 1959. Yeah, so...
No blue plaque?
No.
Yes.
No, that's right.
So home was where then? Where did you get when, obviously, your mum had you and brought you home? Where was
home? Yeah, we lived at Telegraph up at... McFarland's Downs at Telegraph, or Long Rock Downs, and we lived there for the first 7 years of my life. And then we moved to Buzzer Street in down at Porth Creza, number 8 Buzzer Street. And I remember as a youngster being bitterly disappointed that we moved into town. I enjoyed living out in. Up at Telegraph, and obviously all my mates were up there. I was like Marcus Blackwell and various ones were all up there, and I didn't particularly want to go to town. I remember being bitterly disappointed we moved to Buzzer Street. But
what's the first thing you remember as a child?
Well, I suppose sort of going to school was like the biggest thing I remember. As a youngster, you know, that was quite a shock to the system, having to go into school and be all part of that. And I rebelled against that quite strongly.
Did your mum take you in?
Well, I went in as with my sister and brother, then elder brother Stephen, and we used to go in on the bus then. Ron Perry used to take us to school. Ron Perry and Vic Tremwith, they drove the school bus, and I remember one incident where the door fell off the school bus, because we always used to pick Miss Bowen up at the bottom of the hill at Argymore there. She always waited on the corner, and she was obviously in a particularly bad mood one morning, and she swung, it was like a sliding door, and she slid the door open, and it just carried on going and ran off the rails and landed on the road, much to everybody's hilarity. And then Ronnie Perry had to get up and go and put it back on again, which took sort of 10 minutes soon.
So was Miss Bowman of your teachers then when
she
you were
was,
school?
Yeah, she was our, she was like, she taught sort of 9 and 10 year olds, so...
That's the worst situation. You can't even have any malarkey on the school bus if the teacher comes.
No, we all had to behave ourselves. Sit there with her, sit on her hands, and make sure we didn't do anything out of the ordinary.
So, who did you sit with in school?
I sat with Julie Sherris. I seem to remember she was. She stuck in my mind. She had nice legs. I think that's why I probably remembered you.
Well, even at that age, you start early.
Well, you do notice these things, don't you?
So, what about school then? Your attitude to school? Was it something you enjoyed, or was it something you just had to go to?
Well, I enjoyed some aspects of it, and then others I didn't enjoy much. I suppose, like everybody else, I mean, I liked things like PE and the outdoor activities. Side of it I enjoyed very much, and the classroom side of it not quite so much, but I did get on with it okay. And yeah,
which teachers made an impact on you?
Well, Miss Bowen obviously was one, and there was a chap called Mr. Smith, who I don't remember his first name now, but he was quite a strong influence, and he sort of helped us along to realising that you had to actually learn to read and write. You know, it was something that I was never very good at doing, and he sort of convinced us that it was probably a good idea to do it. So we have to thank him.
Did you go to secondary school at Carn Thomas?
Obviously just across the road, really. We were at primary school at Carn Thomas. on one side of the road, and then the secondary school was built in, was opened in 1967. I think I went over there in 1971, so 1971 to 1976. So yeah, that was good, and I enjoyed that. And it was the school was obviously fairly new then anyway, and it was great. We enjoyed that very much. Yeah.
Did you have any thing that you wanted to do in school more than anything else because of an inclination that you wanted to follow a certain career when you'd finished school? Is there anything that really was important to you in lessons?
Well, I enjoyed history, I suppose, and also doing things with your hands, like carpentry and the art, you know, drawing and painting and making models and that sort of thing. I enjoyed doing all that kind of thing.
You got an interest in how things work, haven't you? Because I've noticed this before, when you come into the radio station, you might pick something up, somebody's left a gadget or something, you sort of deconstruct it. And
yeah, that's it, like pulling everything apart. Dad always reckoned I was brilliant at destroying things and no good at putting them back together.
Do you find that when you fix a car or something, you've got bits left over?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, there's always a few bits where you can discard them. Odd nut and bolt here and there don't matter too much.
So, looking back at your childhood, would you rate it as a happy childhood?
Yeah, I think so. Generally, it was all fairly happy. One incident I do remember at school, which I have to say about, was the early memories of school was having a day off for the Torrey Canyon when they bombed the Torrey Canyon, which was 1967. They gave us, all the school children, a day off because obviously it was, they weren't too sure about how the, you know, what was going to happen with these. Well, they were bombing it, and they made an exclusion zone, which included the end of St. Martin's on for where the, a 5 mile exclusion zone, which was sort of from the Seven Stones, included the end, like the Eastern Islands and St. Martin's. Well, I think they were Buccaneer bombers that bombed the Torrey Canyon, and we went up and watched from up on Deep Point, watched them coming in and bombing the Torrey Canyon. So that was a big event in my early life.
I'll bet, yeah.
Yeah.
You had quite a few visits to school as well when it opened. I know Mrs. Thatcher went there. She was Education Secretary then, wasn't she?
She was, yeah. She was. That was in, well, I was in the secondary school then, I think probably 71 or 2 that she came. Yeah, and that was good. She came in, we had an art class, and she came into our art class. But I didn't actually officially meet her. She was sort of shown around by the head teacher, Mr. Osborne, then John Osborne. So.
Now, I seem to remember, I think it might have been Alison Gardner that told me this, that everyone was quite grumpy, because didn't you have to go to school to mock up a classroom on a Saturday?
Yeah, it was a Saturday, that's right. Yeah, we went in as and we were asked to sort of sit around and but I think one thing I remember about it was we got trifle, sherry trifle.
Oh, right.
Which I thought was quite good. It was lovely as well. Yeah, remember that. That was we had a sort of a lunch afterwards and they had sherry trifle. I remember that was, it was really nice.
Gosh, if you fed that to children in school now, there'd be safeguarding issues, wouldn't there?
Yeah, that's right.
Be hell to pay about it.
Yeah.
So did you know what you wanted to do when you left school, when you were still at school?
Well, not really. I mean, I was being the son of a boatman and always being out on the boat, so I enjoyed the boating side of silly. Anyway, I worked for Brian Richards on one of the lobster boats, lobster and crab boats, while I was at school. For the last sort of 3 years or 4 years of school, I went out with him in the holidays and on the weekends and things like that, and helped him pull in pots and all that sort of thing. And in the winter time, helping him make up pots as well. And I enjoyed that very much. It was nice to do that, and you learn your way around as well. You learn an awful lot of you know, what life's like on the water out fishing. So
it's a tough job though, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and generally fairly uncomfortable, wet and smelly as well with the crab and all the horrible bait and bits and pieces you lose. So, yeah, carrying passengers is a lot easier. They don't tend to smell quite as bad, and they usually get on and off the boat on their own as well, which is always good.
So your skills in navigation, is it something, I mean, you can teach people, you know, about reefs and rocks and, you know, the way to navigate around the islands, but with you, is it kind of intuitive in that it's gone in from an early age, it's kind of sunk in from your formative years?
Yeah, I suppose you obviously learn the, like, doing the tickets as far as the boat, you know, the passenger boat side of it goes. You have to do certain tickets for each section of the islands. Like, you do a key to key ticket, which is the first one where you're allowed to take boats out, and you learn all the you know, all the channels and the compass courses for going between the islands and the keys and all the rest of it, and obviously what the tide is as well, and where you're allowed to go and what you're not allowed to do, and then it goes, you go on to like the Eastern Islands and Round Island and that sort of areas, and then you learn to again learn all the courses, the navigation, and the the tidal conditions allow you to do, and then it's the bishop is the last one that you do. So the bishop is like the most technical, really, and there's a lot to learn. You know, you need to know what the rocks are, where the tide is, and a lot of and also being able to get the boat down and back to the bishop without washing everybody out of the boat as well. You know, if you, because of the sea conditions, you know, it can be quite choppy, and it's difficult to get down to the bishop and back if there's a fresh wind and a bit of tide and all the rest of it, then it can be really quite sloppy and pretty uncomfortable out round the bishop. And you've got to know directions you can go to avoid the tide and the poorer conditions, and give everybody a reasonable trip as well. So
were you being fed little bits? I mean, that's a lot of information. Yeah. Were you being fed little pearls of wisdom by your dad over the years from the days when you were a nipper?
Yeah, I suppose you learn it by going out and doing it, really. The only way you learn is to go and see other people doing it, and obviously asking questions. I mean, I probably drove Dad up the wall asking him questions about things. I always remember my grandfather saying about marks. He said, you know, you just, what you need to do is learn where the rocks are, you know, you gotta, and what they're called. You know, you don't worry about the marks so much, because if the visibility is not very good, you can't see any marks. So you need to know where you are, you know, and learn your way around. I didn't really understand what he meant by that, but over the years I've learned that is what you need to do.
Because your dad used to have quite strong views about this, when I spoke to him about it, about boatmen. He thought that it should be islanders, Salonians, that should be boatmen rather than people coming in to operate boats.
Yeah, well, it's that's not quite so true now, because of the navigation is improved by GPS and all that sort of thing. So you're you know, the GPS is sort of helps you to learn your way around as well. So as long as you've got one of those and it works, then the need to know it all or have it all in your head is not so necessary.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because people keep saying that brains don't get used so much now because people don't retain information. They go straight to Google to look stuff up rather than remembering. So could you argue that a lot of important skills, traditional skills in navigating, are going because you just look at a screen now and
you
see
look
the
at
depth
a screen.
Chart, whatever.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't know how the sort of navigation goes in the, like, Navy. I would imagine they have to do it all on a chart anyway without having the aid of electronics, and, you know, they need to show that they can do it all without that sort of equipment. But the, you know, from the practical side of it, they are a huge help. They're and they make you know, a big difference. Like if it's foggy conditions and that sort of thing, then they're invaluable, brilliant machines.
What's the best bit of advice then that perhaps your dad gave you or that you've given to Rebecca?
As far as the navigation goes.
Yeah, we'll stick on that theme at the moment.
Well, I think obviously Dad gave me you know, lots of information over the years. I don't know any specific one. I always remember when I was doing my bishop ticket, I'd sort of been around with Dad doing all sorts and around the rocks and everything else. And Guthrie, well, I was down the quay in the morning, and Guthrie Pender said to me, "Are you doing your ticket this afternoon, your bishop this afternoon?" So I said, "Yeah, we're going out 1 o'clock or whatever it was." And he said, "Well, what's the compass course to from Rosevere to Annet Neck?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And he said, "It's northeast." And the only compass course that Roy Guy asked me when we were going out was, "What's the compass course from Rosevere to Annet Neck?" when we were going around. So, yeah, thanks very much to Guthrie for that one. That was amazing, really.
Well, you've remembered it. That's amazing.
Yeah,
thing,
I remembered it. Yeah. But yeah, it's but you learn. I mean, obviously, I crewed with Dad for several years, as you know, as a youngster when I was going to school, and then after I'd finished, I had an apprenticeship with the council when I left school. Initially, I worked as a carpenter and joiner for the council and did a city and guilds apprenticeship at Camborne Tech.
Any of your handiwork still in existence then?
Well, I made an awful lot of gates and garage doors. I seem to remember making numerous garage doors, which are, some of them are still up and going. So, yeah, it was good. And I enjoyed doing that. And I left the council in about 1980, and then I started with Dad crewing on the boat. Then I worked for him for a couple of years as crew, and then I worked for Frank Thompson as well as crew on the Kingsley, and that was good entertainment and enjoyable as well, you know. And you learn a lot from everybody that you go around with. It's and different people have, you know, different approaches to the boating side of it, so it was interesting seeing how Frank did everything. And it was enjoyable working with him as well. He was a good man.
Was it after Tech, was it always your intention to come back to Scilly then?
Yeah, I always enjoyed Scilly, and I missed, even in Camborne, I missed being by the sea, you know, because you're sort of basically is in the middle of Cornwall. And I didn't really like being that far away from the sea. So I used to go down on the weekends to Penzance or over to Perranporth or the people I stayed with, the husband was a golfer, and he used to go down to Mullion, and I used to go down with him to Mullion Cove on a weekend and go and have a wander down there and around Dollar Cove on the bottom of the golf course there. So I enjoyed doing that.
And we've spoken a fair bit about your work, and it sounds like work, doesn't it? But I mean, when you were growing up, sort of teenage years, what do you do for fun? There must have been some time for fun.
Well, we used to go fishing. That was one of the fishing off the rocks was one of the big things that Alec and my brother and I used to go off on weekends. We would and you know, evenings and that, we would go out and catch wrasse off of Peninnis. That was always and digging bait and that kind of thing. You'd go down on the beach and dig crabs and worms from Porth Cresla and then go out and catch a wrasse or two out off Peninnis. And I enjoyed doing that. And But other than that, we used to do, obviously, play football and that kind of thing and mess around with out on the rocks and climbing around and all that kind of thing, you know, usual children sort of things. Really.
And getting a bit older, I mean, where was the, sort of the place to go then when you're sort of in your teenage years, you're able to go out and have a drink sort of age years?
Yeah, well, we used to go to... Well, the youth club initially was like when we were at school, we used to go to the youth club in the evenings, and that was in school as well. And that was good entertainment. We enjoyed doing that, and you could have music and all those sort of things that you liked, and very sociable. And then when we were able to drink, the Mermaid was always the place to go. The Mermaid was sort of the number one stop there, and the Bishop and Wolf.
Who was the landlord of the Mermaid at the time then?
Well, the first one I remember was Don Prowse, when I was old enough to drink Don,
which would have been 18, obviously,
which was yeah Don Prowse. And then John Dart was in the Mermaid, and I'm trying to think now, Flynn, a guy called I can't think of his name. He was Flynn was his surname. I can't think of his first name now. Somebody will tell you.
Did you ever get into any little scrapes, any shenanigans?
Well, nothing too serious. Obviously, I was worse for drink occasionally, like most weekends.
Never subject to any wind-ups then?
Well, no, I managed to avoid getting into any serious trouble. We were... you know, the only usual sort of teenage things, really.
Is it a help or a hindrance, sort of growing up with having so many cousins and, well, brothers and sisters around you? Because you got a ready-made group of friends, I suppose, in a way, haven't you? And a bit of support, but also stories get back, don't
that's
they?
That's right, yeah, everybody likes telling tales on you. Yeah, that's one of the downsides. Well, it's one of the downsides is living on Scilly, really. It's everybody knows your business, and it's very difficult and to hide from it, you know, because everybody knows who you are, and so you can't get away with anything, so you have to be a good boy.
When do you meet Julie?
I met Julie in 1980. I think she came to Scilly. She worked in the Spanish Ledge, and she worked with Izzy Trenier, who's my uncle Alfie's wife, and she worked as like a chambermaid in the and a sort of waitress for John and Val Humphreys.
And she was just here for the season.
Initially she'd just come here to work for the season. She'd sort of seen the job in a job centre in where she came from in Bridlington, and she came down to Scilly, and then we met up and sort of we hit it off straight away, really, and we were friends, and then obviously it became a little bit more serious later on. and then we got married the next year, so the following year we were married in 81.
So did you have a point then when the season had finished and she had to go back up to Yorkshire?
Yes, she left in sort of October that year, but then she came back again, and she went home for a few weeks. I can't remember exactly how long. And then she came back here, and she worked... I can't remember. She did tying flowers, I think. She worked as a... I can't remember, really. I think she tied flowers for the first season. But I know she did come back here and work, and then she worked again the next season at the Spanish Ledge again.
So did you ask her?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I asked her to marry me, yeah. So
big romantic occasion, did you plan it?
Well, no, it was sort of a late at night job And yeah, but I did get on one knee and ask her, and yeah, and luckily she said yes.
Yeah, but you get an instant yes, or was one of those games you had to wait a couple of weeks?
yeah, that's it. Wait while she stopped laughing. No, she she said yes straight away, so which was nice. Yeah, so good.
So
yeah.
where did you move to when you got married? Did you have your own place initially?
We lived at Watermill, yeah. We were lucky that Florence Watts had a little sort of chalet place at the back of her house in the trees, and it was quite sort of damp and not brilliant, but it was a roof over your head, and we lived there for 3 years, actually, and we were very grateful to Florence as well for letting us stay there, really. And it was a great start, really. And then we moved into Old Town. After 3 years, we were given one of the flats at Old Town, number 8B, in the flat complex at Old Town. So that was great. And then when Rebecca was born in 85... She was born in May 85, and then the next January we were given the house that we're in now, which was great, number 33, so we were delighted with that.
Been there ever since?
Yeah, we have, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Then we managed to buy it on the right to buy thing, which was all good news. But,
did you put a word in with Mrs. Thatcher when she came to visit the school? Is that how that worked?
No. Luckily, I wasn't that politically minded then. But yeah, it would probably have been a good idea to put a word in.
So at that point, were you still crewing for your dad then?
I was in when Rebecca was born in 85. We bought the Black Swan, and I started to run the Black Swan and work. I became a member of the Boatmen's Association then in my own right, and I ran the Black Swan as part of the Boatmen's Association.
Was that a proud moment then, Johnny?
Yeah, it was. It was really good, yeah. I mean, we went round and visited. I mean, obviously I knew all of the boatmen anyway, but I went round and seen them all and spoke to them about it, and everybody said they were delighted to accept me into the Boatmen's Association, so that was good news. And obviously trying to run the boat outside of the Boatmen's Association would have been difficult, you know. It was and you know, trying to work well, not against the Boatmen's Association, but you know, outside of the operation wouldn't have been easy, you know. So I was very pleased to be able to join the Boatmen's Association and work with them.
So what happened to the Black Swan?
Well, when we built the Seahorse she was launched in 97, then the Seahorse took the place of the Black Swan in the pool. So we sold the Black Swan then over to Falmouth. She was bought by the park and ride or park and float thing that they operate in Falmouth. And she's still there now, so still operating and in good shape.
Do you feel any kind of, I don't know, almost like your first car, I suppose, any kind of emotional attachment then to
the
Black Swan?
Yeah, I did enjoy the Black Swan. I mean, she was, in some ways it was hard work because you were always sort of out running around. We used to do all sorts of different jobs, like we did a lot of work for the steamship company, taking freight and you know, over to St. Martin's, and then when the Gew and the Tian, which were the steamship company's launches, when they were laid up, we would do all of the running around, you know, do Tresco and all that as well. So sometimes we were on the run, you know, for all day running freight around during the winter months, obviously, and in the summer we used to always do St. Martin's and take the passengers and the freight to St. Martin's. So But I enjoyed doing that. It was good.
How the islands changed for you? Because I guess certainly when you're growing up, there was obviously tourism. Harold Wilson put the islands on the map, but also there was a lot of interest and competition with people looking for treasure, effectively, wasn't there? I mean, that's all fallen by the wayside to the extent that was then. But was it quite exciting growing up here?
I mean, obviously, Dad was involved with the association initially in sort of, that was about 1967 or something like that. They were diving on that, and then they worked on the Colossus and various other shipwrecks that were around the islands, and he worked with a chap called Roland Morris, who was sort of who funded it all basically, and he that was interesting, seeing all that going on. And Dad used to come home and tell us all sorts of stories about what they got up to, and some good and some bad, but it was generally all it was all good.
Well, you love your history. I mean, it must be quite interesting, because that makes it kind of real, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, Dad showed us some of the coins that they'd found on the associations, like the gold coins that they'd found, and they were like almost like somebody just dropped them in the street, and they were still like shiny, and it was amazing, really, and they only just come out of the water like that.
Hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, that was interesting.
And got some good stories about the competitive times as well.
Well, yeah, that's it, yeah. And then there was obviously various different factions all trying to do the same thing, and that always causes some controversy.
People talk about the sense of humour amongst boatmen. Where do you think it comes from?
Well, I think, obviously, the visitors always are asking lots of different questions, so you tend to try and think of different ways of answering them, and I think that's probably largely where it comes from. And you, because you always get to ask the same sort of questions, what do you do in the winter is always a common one, and, there's various remarks for that one. But I always tell everybody the truth.
Of course.
Yeah.
Have you ever had anybody who has perhaps taken things the wrong way, or taken something literally that you said, like towing in the Bishop Brock for the winter, that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, that happens occasionally. People tend to believe the silliest things. So, that was one of my granddad's yarns, that he reckoned that they, somebody had asked him what happens to the Bishop during the winter time, and he said, well, we pull it in and it gets towed into Porthcawl Bay, and then they give it a paint up and take it back out in the spring. And he seemed to accept that as being fact, but obviously that doesn't happen.
Have you had to ferry around any celebs? I know your dad took, well, we can't get much bigger in terms of celebrity, the Queen, when she came for a royal visit in 67, was it? Or 69?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's it. There's, I've never actually had any sort of the celebrities like that on the boat. We've done various jobs. I remember when Charles and Diana came and stayed on Tresco, we were involved with carrying the security team around, and that involved changing them over at we did one at one changeover at 8 o'clock in the morning, and another changeover at 1 o'clock in the morning. So that was interesting, having to go out at that time of the night and take them up. We used to go to Carnair then and land them at Carnair, and pick up the crew that were finishing and land a crew that were taking over. Yeah, that was an interesting operation.
Of course, you're working right at the cutting edge of tourism at the coalface, aren't you? Over the years, have you noticed tourism change on the island since the time when you were a boy to today?
Yeah, I think the number of tourists is one of the things you notice. Like, there aren't as many people coming to Scilly now as there were, say, 15 or 20 years ago. But we're very lucky that Scilly sells itself, really, and people come here with, you know, whatever expectations they have, but they people come here again and again because they love it. You know, they enjoy the quietness of Scilly, and the you know, the fact that it's safe as well is quite an attractive fact. You know, and people are, you know, they can bring their kids here, leave them playing on the beach, and they know they're going to see them again at the end of the day, and also they're not going to have any of the problems that the rest of the world seems to suffer with. And then, and also, it's, you know, the weather side of it is obviously, you can't guarantee having a sunny day, but when you do have a nice sunny day and a flat calm, and it's, there isn't a better place in the world than being here. And I think, you know, that sells it, and you can do as much marketing as you like, and, you know, sort of pushing it, but it's word of mouth. And you know, the people that come here obviously enjoy it, and they tell their friends, and hopefully their friends come here and enjoy it as well.
And you've built up, I guess, just because you're high profile, because you're on the boats, some good friendships over the years with people, haven't
you? Yeah, that's it. Yeah, lots of people. Well, again, it's, you're sort of a face that people recognise, so which is quite nice. I mean, it's good that people will come up and speak to you, and you know, and I always try to be polite to everybody.
What do you do? And it happens to everybody, I'm sure. I mean, you've got a good memory, I know, but when you can't remember somebody's name, because that's really a British problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Americans
would
just say, sorry, what's your name? But you can't do it. You've got to play along with it, haven't you? So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, what I usually try and do is, hopefully Julie's along with me, and I say, hi, this is my wife, Julie. And then hopefully they'll say what their name is, and if you can get away with it like
you've
that.
You've made Julie a prop.
Yeah.
You'd be in big trouble.
Yeah.
And one of your mates, Al Bear, he's got a character, isn't he?
He is, yeah. Yeah, he's a great guy. He's he comes over basically to go shrimping, really. That's his main aim.
It's a long way to come, really.
It is, yeah. I know, yeah. He's, but, yeah, and he enjoys his music as well. He likes coming over, and he gets the accordion out and plays a bit of accordion and the Breton pipe, which he's famous for. And everybody wishes he'd leave the Breton pipe at home, but he brings it along. And it's a bit like a bagpipe with no bag on it, and it sounds just the same, really, sort of a bit of a screech, like somebody's murdering a cat.
It's a specialist instrument, that's why you don't see them on pop videos. There is a reason, same as bagpipes, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
So, have you got any musical skills?
No, I haven't, no, and I enjoy singing, but everybody tells me I sound terrible, so I tend to avoid singing as well.
Now, in terms of tourism, I know you're passionate about it, and you've done a number of things to be an ambassador for the islands. Mm. Island Paris was one of those things, which, of course, has got you known to a new audience of people who might not even have been here yet.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the whole experience of Island Paris?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I think it was, again, it was a good advert for the islands, and it was on sort of BBC Two and primetime viewing. And it's amazing how many people that come now still say, you know, they've seen the Island Paris and enjoyed it. And I think it's they say the camera never lies, but it does a little bit. I think when you see all the sort of the film and the footage that they show on the TV, you're sitting in your armchair and it all looks nice and blue and sunny, and everybody says, oh, that looks fantastic, which it is, but it's not always quite like it looks on the TV.
Were you okay about watching yourself back? Because I couldn't watch the stuff that I was in. I was fast-forward it now, quick.
Yeah, I always find it a bit strange listening to the... hearing your own voice. That's one thing that is funny, because you think, well, I don't sound like that, but obviously that's how you do sound. So, yeah... but I get used to that, obviously, doing the radio and various things. You hear it, you know, like when I do the morning broadcast, and then I hear it when I'm down having a cup of coffee and they're playing Radio Silly.
I just put on repeat and go to the pub. A lifesaver.
Yeah.
So, and on Island Paris, they had a running joke. They were always sort of making out that your boat wasn't ready, weren't they?
Yeah.
Or was that something you agreed and you're okay about?
Well, Nigel Farrell was the director, and he sort of said, well, we need some sort of angle. And so he said, well, we'll say that your boat's not ready. And so I said, well, fair enough, you know, we'll go along with it. And but yeah, I mean, he was right. Things usually run a bit tight anyway on the when you're doing the you're sort of trying to get the boat ready, and you get like the surveyor always turns up sort of towards the end of March, and it's always a rush to try and get everything organized and all your safety equipment and all your gear aboard the boat before the surveyor arrives. So, you know, it's partly true.
So you get loads of people come up to you making jokes about the boat not being ready.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, everybody saying, oh, you managed to get your boat ready. Yeah, but that's the way of it. But yeah, I think it's it was all sort of in good nature.
You have actually developed a catchphrase, haven't you? Because if you want to be a star, you need a catchphrase. Look at Eric and Ernie.
Yeah, that's
all the
it.
Other people, the Fast Show, and of course yours is a lovely day for boating.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I noticed Erica's got little. Erica Hicks has made up some little sort of fridge magnets and key rings with a picture of the Seeking and a lovely day for boating on them. So. Yeah, good for her.
Okay. Are you getting 20%?
Well, I'm not getting any commission. I should charge. Never thought about that. But no, she's welcome to it.
And he also got elected as our tourism ambassador in the Daily Mirror Awards about 2-3 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
What was that like, going up to London?
Yeah, that was good. It was interesting doing it, and I hadn't really... It was the Island Partnership that put me forward, and obviously we were sort of shortlisted to go up and do this interview in London, and I hadn't realised how difficult it is to try and sell yourself. You know, when somebody says to you, right, say what you do and sell yourself, do it in 30 seconds, and so... You got to stand there and try and make it sound like you're the bloke that they need to vote for, and it's very difficult. It was, and I did about 5 or 6 different takes, and this guy was sort of filming it, and he was just saying, "Well, just say what you think you want to say," and. Hopefully it came across right. I mean, we got about 15,000 votes, I think. So it was quite good, really. I think we were third in the list of people. So there was some guy with an orange suit and bright coloured sunglasses that actually won it. So
it was a right show off.
Yeah.
I'm glad he didn't win. Yeah. If that was what they were judging you on.
Yeah. Yeah. So you sort of think, well, perhaps it was a blessing in disguise you didn't win.
It was from quite a camera, which county it was from, but it was somewhere big.
Yeah,
somewhere
that's
about
right.
200,000 times the population of Silly. So
yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Can't expect to win, can you? In that
No, you can't. No,
unjust recount.
Yeah.
And talking about winning. You've been elected as a councillor.
I have, yeah. Yeah, that's it, and I enjoy that. That was a year in January, so... and I'm enjoying the council side of it. It's interesting seeing how the political thing works, really. There's an awful lot of reading involved with it, you know, and there's a lot... to the actual meetings as well that you don't realise goes on from the outside. And, I'm enjoying it very much.
Did your dad give any grounding in that, or did he just keep his council business to himself, really?
Yeah, Dad never said anything. He never ever discussed any of it with us. He wouldn't talk about it.
But would you have been interested at the time?
Well, no, I mean, obviously there's some subjects where you sort of ask him what's going on, but he was, he'd always say, well, that's council business and that's it. He wouldn't discuss it, so...
Do you think he'd be pleased that you're a councillor now?
I think so, yeah. I think he would be pleased and wished me all the best as far as the council side of it went. Yeah, I don't know whether I would have liked to have been a councillor with him there as well. It's difficult to say, but I'd never really thought about standing for the council before, and then, you know, when Dad passed away, that was 3 years ago now, and you know, I thought then, well, you know, perhaps I should stand up and be counted as well, and so that's why I stood.
So you wanted basically to make sure there was a Hicks in the chamber.
Well, yeah, that's it, and I think local, you know, the local influence is always good. You know, it's and I think it's Scilly needs support. You know, people have to be here for the benefit of Scilly rather than for their own benefit, or, you know, whatever other reason they might have for going on the council. But you know, I think, you know, I'm sort of out for what's best for Scilly is what I like to stand for.
You fit in also the lodge around all of this, don't you? Around boat times and council meetings.
Yeah, that's right.
That's,
yeah,
important to you as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I enjoy the lodge. I'm a member of the lodge here, obviously, the craft lodge, and also the chapter. And I belong to a couple of lodges on the mainland as well, the chapter and the mark on the mainland, which is... which involves quite a lot of time away. So, but yeah, I enjoy the going on and for the meetings, which are largely in Penzance on the mainland, and also meetings here on Scilly. So,
I know you've done quite a bit of study on that. Is that, again, your kind of interest in history that's driven that?
Yeah, that's it, because there is quite a lot of sort of history to the lodge. And you have to memorise the various bits of ceremony that you do. You read it and memorise it, and then you know, do it in the lodge. So I enjoy doing that, and yeah, it's quite satisfying to be able to reproduce what you've learnt actually in the lodge, you know, and then to do it without having to need people telling you out what to say as well is quite useful.
Has it opened kind of social doors for you? Not necessarily here, but I mean, some people will use it if they travel abroad, for instance, that they'll hook up with people with a local lodge just to socialise with when they go in their jollies. Yeah. Do you do that at all?
I don't know. I obviously belong to the lodge on the mainland, and at the moment I've just been given a job as one of the provincial junior deacon for the Mark, which is like a, you're sort of an ambassador. Then you go around all the various lodges in Cornwall, visiting their lodges for installation meetings, mainly when there's a new master put in the chair. You go along. And there's like a team that goes around as the provincial team, and I'm part of that for the Mark this year. So I'll do quite a few visits away in the winter for that. So I'm looking forward to that.
So that's, you know, quite a lot of work, because I mean, most people, if they're in Cornwall, they just get in the car, don't they?
Yeah, that's it. Well, I'm fairly lucky though. I'm a friend of mine lives in St Just, and fly away from here, and I stay with him in St Just, and then he takes me around to whatever meetings are going on. He comes along, and it all works very well, really.
Mm. Yeah. Now, we talked about the sort of family history of boating. Of course, Rebecca is a boat person.
Yeah, but that's it. Yeah,
would you use, you know, like the council has a chairman, even though it can be a woman.
Yeah.
Would Rebecca be a boatman?
Well, she does wear a shirt saying boatman.
Yeah.
So I suppose technically she's a boatman, yeah.
Because boatwoman sounds a bit strange, doesn't it?
I don't know why.
Yeah. Too many syllables.
Yeah, boat girl, I suppose she should have boat girl rather than boatman. But yeah, she's and she enjoys that. You know, she did her key to key ticket, and she's taken the seeking for me on several occasions, and she enjoys the boating as well. And obviously at the moment she's sort of busy with other things, but hopefully she'll come back to it in the future.
So is that the plan, to try and make sure that the family continuation goes on with Rebecca? And are you coaching Noah,
your grandson? That's it. Yeah, young Noah, yeah. Well, he's obviously he's only 4 at the moment.
Start him young.
That's right, yeah. And he comes out on the boat and he loves it. You know, he enjoys, he's into everything and he enjoys the boating. So, you never know. Hopefully he'll come on and he'll enjoy getting out on the water as well.
Two final questions. I always finish these interviews with, Fraser. First of all, why do you love Scilly? And then I'll ask you about your favourite view. So let's find out why you love Scilly. Obviously, this place you're born and brought up in, but doesn't necessarily follow that you like the place you're born and brought up in. You do. So why?
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably it's what I'm familiar with. And, you know, I think Scilly has a lot to offer as well. I think it's, it's a beautiful place to live, and it's, it's what I love, I suppose. It's, you know, that's the way of it. It's,
Favourite view? You've seen enough of the island, so which bit do you like the most?
Favourite view would probably have to be the Western Rocks, I would say, like from looking out from Pereglis out across the Western Rocks, I would say is probably one of the best views, I think, out towards the Bishop. Yeah, lovely.
Great stuff. Fraser, thank you.
Thank you.